A Night In is brought to you by Ashwood Music.
I'm Nick Elliott, rock art photographer, and we're having a night in.
Well, hello, and welcome to another night in. And I'm joined by a very, very special guest and friend tonight here at my place, and that is the legend that is Sandy Newman.
Hi, Sand.
Thank you.
How are you, my friend?
I'm okay. I'm bearing up against the strains of modern society.
Ah, yeah. Welcome to the UK. Yeah. Hope you enjoy your stay.
It's been a while. Bye.
I tell you, it is absolutely marvellous to see you.
You too.
It's been a while, isn't it, since we caught up?
I think it's probably more than 2 years now.
Is it really?
I think, yeah.
Jesus.
I think so.
That's not good.
No, I know, but it happens, doesn't it?
No, friends should not spend that long, you know, not kind of seeing each other.
Distance. It's not that it's that far.
Well, it's that, and it's busy lives, you know, mileage, things to do and all the rest of it, you know.
Yeah.
People to see.
But no, it's great to see, it is great to see you.
You're looking well.
Thank you very much.
And I'm so pleased you could come along and spend the night in, and we're going to play a few tunes and talk about some great things. A lot of things that I've got to kind of just reminisce on.
I've
got stuff, mate. I've got tons of shit that
loads
I'm going to talk
stuff.
About. Tons of shit.
Excellent.
But I'm going to open the show with actually a little bit of Mick and Keith.
Works well.
First show of 2018.
Is this your first one?
Yes, it is. Yeah, first night in.
Do you mind if I won't crunch
No, help yourself.
Obviously, you're not recording now.
Yes.
Oh, you're just recording everything?
Whatever.
As in, okay.
We got crisps, live crisps, are now broadcasting.
Oh,
fantastic.
Faulty crisp bag.
Crisp alert all over the floor.
I shall tidy up.
Don't worry about it. The woman comes in 3 days a week.
Don't want to upset the cleaning.
You're all right. Good track. Bit of the Stones. I certainly with the track listing, I mean, you sent over some classical stuff. You know, when it actually came over to the studio and us put the playlist together.
Only the one.
I don't know. I think.
Oh, you mean classic stuff?
As in classic tracks.
Well, I must be honest. I find it really hard to hone down to specifics.
Well,
because when I try and zone into that territory, I've often thought that just to try and get a handle on a specific period in your life.
Difficult.
One thing jumps to the other. Especially when it's formative, because you know, and most of the music that I really liked, and I think possibly selected, was moments of inspiration rather than that's my favourite.
Oh right,
blah record. You know?
That's how you came to shortlist the 10 that you did, is it?
Kind of, but I did it remarkably quickly. Because I thought if I deliberate on this one, I'll never get there.
No, it's difficult, isn't it? And certainly for somebody of your kind of calibre that had been in the business for so long.
But that's the business. The business, inspiration is for everyone. You know, inspiration is for everyone. It's not necessarily just the nature of being in the profession, you know. Much of what I liked drove me to the profession, you know.
Oh, yeah, yes, of course. That was the influence why you went into it.
Yeah. But a lot of it was family. Not by being pushed that way, but by being the youngest.
Really?
Yeah, I was the youngest of my family by far.
That's how it all kind of come about, and the moms and...
It's how it's basically that, at this stage in my life, it's how I view where I really actually came from in terms of musically.
Right.
And it was a whole kind of cross-section of what had come before me that I grew up with as a child. You know, as a child, I was subjected to all these things. I had two elder sisters, my eldest sister being 10 years older than me. The other sister was 8 years older than me.
Right.
And my brother was just coming up 6 years older than me. So much of what I heard as a child was stuff that was all, for me, it was all just amazing. Only because I was getting to hear it at all.
Yeah.
You know, so, and there was a lot of different changes in their life. There was a lot of different changes in society. You know, so, you know, I'm 67 in March.
Right. So what kind of year are we talking about here, Sand? You know, when that kind of transition period where you thought, shit, man, this is what I want to do. This is where I want to go with this.
Oh, as that... Well, that was possibly slightly later than when... Certainly... things like Elvis was around because of my sisters with the early records. I'm talking about 78s and things like that, you know, with the scratch sound, and even my brother.
Would that be this Elvis?
What? Yeah, it was that Elvis, yeah. Absolutely.
Obviously one of your tracks that you picked, and wonderful, man.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
I mean, the sound of that, I remember the sound of it because what we had at home was pretty primitive in these days, and it was how things sounded.
Right.
The scratching of the...
Yeah, yeah.
It was almost like part of the gig.
Yeah, yeah.
And then there was the crossover with the 78s, 45s, plastic, you know, as opposed to the Bakelite 78 records.
Yeah.
And I remember that as a rugrat as a child.
Well, funnily enough, I mean, I've got quite not an extensive collection of 78s, that'd be unfair. I know my dad had a lot of, you know, even Al Jolson's and Glenn Miller's and that on original.
Mammy, how I love you, my dear old mammy.
Fantastic, man. Yeah,
oh, absolutely.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
You know, and I think I've probably got about a dozen of Survive, which I've now got, and they're literally permanently wrapped.
Yeah.
You know, and protected, and they're in the loft.
Right.
You know, out the way.
Artifacts.
Never to be opened until death, you know, that kind of thing.
Well, by which time's far too late.
Indeed. But for somebody, you know, when they're reading the will, they're going to be able to pull it out, you know, which will be really nice.
That's
but
right.
No, I mean, all that kind of thing. This guy was quite a bit before my time, but in saying
almost likewise, except there was the parallel. I can see it through, at this stage of my life, I can see all that through my various family members' eyes, even including the actual influence of the Frank Sinatras from before me, my mother and father's generation, and before that, the, as you say, the Al Jolsons. I mean, it was a huge thing in Britain. You know, you're talking well after the war, the American influence in music and culture after the war was... It was quite influential. Lots of people wanted to emigrate to America for the great new world.
Again, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Get
yeah.
a decent job and get ahead in life.
Opportunities and all that.
And when you look back at my lifetime, born in 51, when you look back at the way it's captured on film from that period, it almost looks like it was 40 years before 1951.
Right.
It really looks old. And it was. And it was poor. It was a poor country. Overall, it looked to be a poor country. You know, it was a shell of what had been wasted in the war years.
Yeah.
You know, people were thin and they wore all these big suits because they were all thin.
Well, I mean, you'd still got rationing in 53, hadn't you?
Yeah.
In the UK. I mean, it was really the 60s was the only time that it really started to get a hold, wasn't it? When the place was starting to get rebuilt. Despite the fact that for me, the 60s and the 70s were certainly the 70s was my era. That was, you know, that changed my life. That was when it all kicked off.
60s changed me big time.
Yeah, yeah. What kind of year do you think would be the define?
Well, definitely when the Beatles arrived.
Right, okay.
When the Beatles arrived, I mean, again.
What is this for you?
Well, musically, my brother, I just kind of followed in my brother's footsteps.
Right.
My big brother played the violin, so I was sent to play the violin as a child.
Okay.
As a child. You know, sure. I played it when I was just from the age of 5 to the age of 8.5, 9 years. I played violin.
Did you really?
Yeah, but I can't play it anymore. I know where it is, but the actual physicality of playing it,
yeah,
you know,
yeah, it just don't work.
Nah, it's gone.
Yeah.
And the only reason that happened was because we moved from quite central Glasgow. Family moved to...
Which is where you were born?
Yes.
Yeah.
No, I was born in Lennox Town, which is just outside Glasgow.
Oh, right, okay.
Just outside, at the foot of the Campsie Hills. And it had formerly been in a... It had been a mental hospital. So as I often say...
Do you think that affected you
at all? I was born in a madhouse, do you know what I mean? It was later a maternity unit after the war years.
Right.
And I was born there. But yeah, I grew up in Glasgow, right in the centre of Glasgow.
Right, lovely.
My father worked in the... He worked for the Clyde Trust, which was the river authorities.
Okay.
He worked on one of the ferries. He was an engineer on the ferries. So we lived in central Glasgow for the first 8 years of my life. And as I say, I followed my brother's footsteps, went to the same violin teacher, who I still remember, passionately.
Goodness me.
Passionately. Mr. Ruddick.
Wonderful, El. People like that kind of shape your life, isn't it?
Well,
from way back,
very
I have
much,
a few of them
very
myself.
Much. And the thing, I even get tearful thinking about it, because passion.
Right.
Passion.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's my main driver. That and insanity.
But that's the thing that you remember about me, he was a big, thick Slavic head. He was Polish. He was what was affectionately known as a Polak, Polish Jew.
Yeah.
And he had settled in Glasgow. He was a fabulous, you remember teachers as fabulous player when he played something. But it was the passion. But he used to foam at the mouth, so you could never forget him.
Right, okay.
And the classroom for the violin was at my brother's secondary school, which had fish tanks in it. So that's what I remember from my early musical, learning the violin, you know. And then we moved. And it's terrible to say, but the little teacher I had to pursue the violin was a little ineffectual woman with a really bad squint.
And I
just couldn't take it yet. I mean, I know I was young and I couldn't handle it at all. I'd had this hugely authoritarian, respected figure teaching me to play and really loving the fact of it all.
With
and then all of a sudden it just went sort of whittled away into nothingness. And I stopped it. But then you know, it's 8.5 years old.
Yeah.
You know, you're at primary, a new
there
primary
was,
school,
there was
new
to
challenges
change
in your life, you know.
Yeah. Trying to change direction with that.
But then, see, the music was always at home anyway. You know, my oldest brother then tried jazz was part of the gig. You know, they all came in with their pie albums of the Golden Guinea series,
definitely,
which
was
one side was Acker Bilk, the other side was Chris Barber.
Yeah.
With featuring Ottilie Patterson. All these things, you know, I remember.
Yeah.
And that was that transition. Then the Radiogram came along.
Now I remember the Radiogram.
Which sounded fantastic. Oh,
Jesus, man. That was big.
It was a deal.
It was a deal, a big deal. It was in my family. Mm. You know, I can remember my dad. In fact, I can remember going to get it with mum and dad and everything. You know.
Likewise.
Oh, man. But life changing.
There was an awful lot of things that I did get to do with my mum and dad because I was virtually Tail End Charlie, if you like.
Right, sure.
And there wasn't... I don't mean the mass poverty issue, but there wasn't any money around.
No.
You know, it was hand, week to week.
Yeah, of course.
Hand to mouth. I just still remember, dare I say it, I still remember references to the pawn shop.
Oh, right.
So, you know...
Yeah. Well, they're making a comeback, aren't they?
Well, they're big in the States. More than made a comeback. Strangely enough, I was in Glasgow. Only... Well, it's now... Now it's now, I'm saying it only. It's now about 2 years. No, about a year and a half.
Roger, behave yourself.
Settle down, Keith.
Calm down, would you?
Oh, boy. Yeah, that's another one, isn't it? The Who.
Well, I mean, again, you know, certainly with the playlist, I mean, obviously these are 10 of my favourite tracks. But I wanted to kind of keep it in keeping with where you and me and our relationship is, because we actually met in Nashville, didn't we?
That's correct, yeah.
Which, believe it or not, was 7 years ago.
I know.
2010, the first time I went out there. And we hooked up out there, didn't we? And we met each other there.
Well, that was it, really.
Fantastic, man. Life-changing experience.
It was, yeah, it was. I mean, it was for me. It was a bit of a venture for me at the time. I'd always wanted to do an album, and I did. I got myself in this situation to do a solo album, because I'd always written a bit throughout my whole career.
Yeah.
From really quite young. And, you know, much of it was always channeled into Marmalade products, because I was in the Marmalade, obviously.
Indeed, yeah.
The Window was more of an opportunity. Nothing really came to too much, but albeit that some of my songs got through to being recorded particularly well in some cases, you know.
That's a nice album, though, isn't it? Because you gave me a copy of that, signed copy of it, and it's a really nice album. Yeah, it's really nice.
Well, yeah, I mean, I just wanted to get me down again, which was kind of where I started was really in. Where I started performing in front of people was not on my own behalf, it was on behalf of a folk club, where people who had already got into the Bob Dylans and the Simon and Garfunkels, yeah, could not play, but they could sing.
Yep.
And I became a little bit of a very, very, you know, only for a few months when I look back at it now, but it was in a different school from my school.
Yep.
They had a folk club, ours didn't. And I was already playing because my brother had played guitar, so there was a guitar in the house.
Sure.
And I played a few chords, and then I got a bit better at it. Then all that stuff came along, the Bob Dylans and the Beatles, the Bob,
yep,
Dylan, the whole thing. I was right in there. Because I loved it. I loved the music, and that was a learning, and I'd learned from Tail End Shadows stuff, you know, the books and,
yep,
Bert Whedon.
Sure,
Tune,
yeah.
Of
oh,
Day.
Yeah, yeah. Teach yourself, oh, guitar, yeah. Bert,
oh,
Whedon.
Yeah.
It was
Day.
A must.
Tune of the Day was just like,
oh,
an
God,
iconic.
Oh, you know? Man, I know.
And later in life, I was fortunate enough to meet him.
What, you met Bert Whedon?
Oh, I've got more than met, yeah, yeah.
Really?
I've photographed him. Yeah.
Wonderful.
Well, we did a... Shall I tell you that story?
Yeah, please do.
Yeah, well, later, in the early 2000s, you remember the Burn Knights?
Yep.
Of course you do.
Yeah.
The Burn Knights,
yep,
who, you know, had been made very famous in the 60s for, yep, the comedy records.
Yeah, and the Russ Abbott Show.
That's
which,
right,
they featured on every Saturday, almost.
Yeah,
Saturdays.
I mean, they were very funny, particularly,
yeah,
Butch the big fella.
Yeah.
Anyway, later in life, they always sort of diversed into theatres, booking their own shows, blah, 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 and they were getting close to retirement at that time. And they thought they would put a package together, so they approached a few bands,
yeah,
to say, well, would you like to come in on an equal split on this tour, blah, 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 we'll book it, we'll take another share. And anyway, it ended up coming to fruition. And that would... The Burn Knights, obviously... The Marmalade, the Fortunes, Tremolos.
Goodness me, right.
But they gave it something extra, because they'd always been in more in the entertainment
yeah,
field.
Definitely.
So they wanted to do a feature in the show with four guitarists. They wanted to do a feature in the show with the singing drummers. You know, novelty value.
Yeah, of course.
And obviously they were great at doing the spoof, mm-hmm, in between time. They,
yeah,
did their little set, but they did their set at the beginning of the show. And then they were the two kind of presenters, if you like, were free to present. And it was like a show, proper.
Wonderful.
And it was good. It was good. And the first tour, I think, was about 40-odd days. Next tour was a bit less. The next tour was a little bit less. And then it became occasional, and then it disappeared.
Yeah.
But it lasted a while, and it had
in
some
the UK.
Strength. And only,
yeah,
in the, only
in the UK.
Well, an offshoot of it went to Australia, which was us and the Fortunes. But
right,
it was just basically the two bands,
okay,
to be honest. you know.
So the Burt Whedon thing came through that, didn't
well,
it?
Well, the very first tour, when they mentioned the four guitarists thing, it was a question of... obviously, we'd had meetings with the guys that ran the bands, which of which I was one,
yeah,
on the Marmalade's behalf. And it was suggested that the Guitar Boogie Shuffle came along. And it, now, I just happened to know a great presenter who very quite friendly with Burt Whedon, a guy called Alan Thompson, who lives up... lives up in Norfolk, strangely enough.
Oh, really?
Yeah. But he'd worked in Reading for many years, BBC. He knows everything about everybody. Yep. And he got me an introduction, and we actually got Bert to appear at the very first night of the whole show.
Fantastic.
In the Guitar Boogie Shuffle thing.
Really?
Yeah. Which we did at a pace. And, you know, and he had his wife there. You know, he did the token opening of it, and then he took over because he was quite old.
Yeah.
And in the audience that evening, his best friend, well, not in the audience, he came with Mr. Jim Marshall.
Really?
As in Marshall.
As in, yeah,
he was
Marshall
one of his best friends. In the huge stretch limo.
Really?
And Jim Marshall's wife, who was actually... had been his Jim Marshall's son's wife.
Okay.
Bit of a bizarre one. But and Mr. Marshall had wanted to play the drums because he was a drummer. And we had to say, no, sorry.
Really?
Not that he was upset. But
what a wonderful story.
Yeah, but we had Bert on. And obviously, before we did all this, at the time I got involved in a bit of... extracurricular, apart from musician style thing, and suggested that if we're doing this tour, let's do a program.
Right.
And strangely enough, everybody from all the bands, representatives, went, nah, including the Bar and Nights. Nah, it's a waste of time. So I put a proposal together in a proper business fashion.
Yep.
And said, well, guys, it seems to me that the first thing you want when you walk into a theatre is somebody to shove a programme in your face, whether you say yes or no is a different story. But I said, well, no, we've been there before, I mean, so it can end up being a waste of money. I said, well, I put a proposal together on paper. If I do it and you get X percent and I handle everything, are you up for it? And they all went, yeah, okay. So I did. So I got a top photographer, a guy called Stu Williamson, at the time, who had formerly been a short-term drummer in Marmalade when Alan Whitehead left, became a Kodak winner of World Awards and office in Dubai and all the rest of it.
That weren't Stu the guy Williamson, who used to work at a studio in Market Harbour?
Ah, Stu. Yeah. Who set fire to his house the only night I stayed in it.
Is that...
By
is
making
that...
chips.
Really? I didn't know that story.
His father was the main rep for Sonor Drums.
Okay.
So he became a drummer. And it didn't work out with Marmalade. It didn't work out. He was with us for, I think he was maybe with us for about 4 or 5, maybe 6 months.
Okay.
And at that time we had another guitar player who came from Leicester, who had a great friend whose second name I don't remember, Brian was his first name, who taught several drummers from Marmalade photography.
Right.
One of them being Alan Whitehead.
Okay.
Second one being Stu Williamson.
Yep.
And that was it. He taught them to be photographers.
Really?
Because he was old school, like you.
Yeah.
Like you love what you are. You know, the real deal.
Goodness me.
Piece of film in a dark room.
But yeah, well, proper photography. Yeah, proper art. Proper
yeah, well, art. It is. Yeah. You know, proper you can... You can. I don't know. I've never done it, but I know where it is. I know what you can do with one little piece of negative if you've got some head on you, you know.
Well,
and if it's clearly shot and if it's done properly.
Yeah.
No, it's a whole deal. It's like an artist painting a picture.
Yeah, it is.
I think.
Yeah, I agree.
Unfortunately,
that's changed.
You are one.
I am one.
Have a crisp, son.
Talking about crisp,
Chris,
have
a biscuit.
I'm going to introduce the biscuit. Well, it's usually cake.
Well, but cake.
Because of basic medical issues, we've had to give a rain check on the cake.
I brought one for you, though.
I know.
I brought my fave.
I know, fruitcake, which is
proper
up there, man.
Personally, if it was a proper wedding, it would be wedding cake, which is a proper fruit mix.
Yeah, I totally agree. I'm a massive fan.
Cherry's moist. Oh, beautiful.
Moist is good. We like moist on this show. Yeah, a Saturday night in, we like moist.
Moist is good on a Saturday night.
You know where
good
I'm going.
Good most nights. But go for it.
Indeed. So I'm going to bring on one of my favourite star biscuits, which is a Jammy Dodger.
Damn.
And these are pucker
Jammy Dodgers.
I don't think they actually taste as good as they used to. But because I had a couple earlier on, but they just seem to, you know
they
what
used,
it is.
Well, they used to work wonderfully well with
them. Oh, dear. I don't know what it is with this country, Sandy. You know, so much stuff don't taste like it used to.
Well,
you know?
I don't think the stuff
bloody
is
awful.
As it used to be.
No, it's not. It's not.
I don't think it is.
Fruit and everything, you know, they knackering around with it so it lasts about 5 years, you know, before you actually get it. And I can't be doing with that kind of stuff. You know.
Well, this is the thing that, you know, it comes full cycle, and then you start getting told that this may not have affected you in your lifetime, but now it might be affecting you, and you should just eat fresh and product. And...
No, well, I mean, I do that anyway.
Well,
you know,
so do I. And
I'm quite obsessed
kind of
with that
have.
Shit.
But you like a little bit of nonsense now and again.
Nonsense, you know, gets live out.
My favourite one was. And it wasn't an expression I'd heard before, but when I started to get very familiar and friendly with Dave D, I was going, let's have a fucking plate of filth, love. Double bacon, double eggs.
Oh,
double
full Monty.
Big grease up.
Oh, you can't whack a full Monty.
No, but when you feel like you can't whack it.
Brought up on... No, you can't. No,
that was his plate of filth.
Oh, full Monty, that was really big. It was in my upbringing. Well, I'm going to play a track now, which is one of the tracks that reminds me of you, how we met, and certainly Nashville.
Right.
And there's a few stories around this, but...
Johnny Cash.
You know what I'm saying? Is this wonderful or...
All around the bend. What's remarkable?
We were singing this, do you remember? We sung this through the streets in Nashville.
But you also always think of Johnny Cash as the real deal, a big, deep voice.
Yep.
He actually pitched to that when he was... It's not that high. It's not that low.
No.
You're singing away down there in the boots.
Yeah, it's not exactly John Wayne, is it? That kind of...
The hell I do.
Are we going to have an impression 5 minutes?
No, that's my...
Why not? No, I like
that's
it.
That's my eldest son's.
I like it.
He's great at that.
It's but this track, we sung this walking through the streets in Nashville, if you remember.
We were drunk at the time, perhaps.
I think there was a few tizers had gone on. And they.
Yeah, there was a few.
we
the Cadillac Ranch.
That's it. That was the place. That was it. Broadway.
I've actually got a picture of you.
Have you really?
Somewhere in the dim and dark, I've got it in a file somewhere in my gut. Because the pictures I took on my whatever digital camera, I wasn't pre-phone, but I didn't.
Right.
I had a wee camera with me. I've still got them. And I took a great picture of you. I think you were probably phoning home, England home.
Right.
And it's just you standing at a corner. It's not particularly arty, but for you, you would go, "You bastard!"
I'd love to see that, because I never saw any of the shots.
I had come out for a fag.
Yeah.
Because I was basically shitting myself, which sounds bizarrely stupid, I suppose, after all these years of being a performer. I'd never actually performed in America in any shape or form.
Right.
Ever. So to be doing it completely... stripped down naked on your tod, was like, well,
which you did do, didn't you? One night in Cadillac Ranch.
Did a few, yeah. Well, the Cadillac Ranch.
Yeah.
It was effectively, if you like, the big one.
Yeah.
You know,
No.
I believe it's long gone now. The actual premise.
Is it really?
Well, it's moved on. I'm sure many of them.
Okay, that's a really. Yeah, we spent a lot of time there, didn't we?
Yeah, we did.
We did.
Yeah.
In between various different PR
exercises.
Parties and whatever and all kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But no, it was a wonderful time. But that well, the whole Johnny Cash thing, I mean, obviously seeing where he lived and where Roseanne Cash lived, and some work with her, you know, with the Cambridge book, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, it was just... I just thought I had to put a Johnny Cash track in there.
Well, I'm so glad you did that, Paul.
I'm going to find another one, actually, because there's something else here that also reminds me of
what you got in that.
I've got all sorts in here, all sorts.
Bloody night.
But this...
What's this about?
This is actually... This is the track that you did in the Cadillac Ranch.
I did, but yeah.
And I'll never forget this. This particular experience, you just stood up there, acoustic guitar, that's all.
Yeah.
And I personally think that this was one of the best singles of the 60s. I really do.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it really was. It's remarkable how it's a song, you know. It's not my song, as you know.
So this is off the album that we worked on together. This is your version.
It's just a later version of... Yeah. Yeah. I'm trying to listen to which version, because there's been so many. It's not the original, it's me singing it, of course.
It is.
It's me singing everything.
This is off Penultimate, the album which was your last album.
Yeah, it's me and John singing everything.
Which is the one that... You got me in to shoot all the artwork, and then we went on to do the limited edition coffee table book. And we spent.
Have you got it with you?
Got it with me.
Good, mate.
It's here, mate. It's here.
Lovely.
I've signed it.
Don't let me touch it. I've been eating crisps.
Okie dokie.
Have you got a white glove?
It's a white glove gig.
It is a white glove gig.
It is a white glove gig,
I know.
Yeah. Yeah. But no, it's been a while since, since we've seen each other, which is the reason for I haven't actually given you your copy.
Yeah.
But no, it is with me.
Yeah, it's more than the icing on the cake, if you forgive the expression. But the fact that you did that... of course it is, yeah. Yeah, I'm not sure if a lot of people liked that, because a lot of people lived the song for the solo.
Right.
And I thought, we're going to do it again. Well, I'd done this myself.
I think it's a lovely version.
We're going to do it again, then. You kind of... Because half of that original solo was the tape turned around backwards. And
right.
It was basically Junior Campbell living out something. No, that's what I always thought that at the time when I was a young boy when I heard the record.
Really?
Yeah. You think about something, the sound of the Clapton solo on it, the nature of the song, the influence. I'm not detracting from anything here.
Sure.
But Marmalade's Deal Then, it'd come off a huge hit record with Obladi Oblada. The contract was up. It'd come off a number one.
Yeah.
And the management at the time negotiated a deal with Decca Records where they got free studio time. That was almost unheard of.
Look at me.
And I say this to this day, if it hadn't been for the free studio time, I don't think there would have been a record that was as brilliant as the original Reflections of My Life.
Because you could spend the time and go back, redo.
There's a lot of buggering about went on there, I think.
Right.
Because it's just not something that you would go in and say, well, we've got 3 hours. No way. Experimental.
No, you know. I mean, this is a wonderful track. It's a wonderful, wonderful
track.
Well,
it was. It achieved the Distinguished Royalty Awards in America for Junior Campbell and Dean Floyd, who wrote it. Where they got double royalties after many years.
I've got to say...
On plays.
Well, for me, I think I really like that version, obviously, you know, because of our kind of relationship and the rest of it. But I just love that version. I think the thing is really, it's just a little bit more has been added to it to lift it away from that kind of 60s feel. I mean, not that I had a problem with the 60s. A lot of it was very good.
Well, there's no strings or anything on it. No. There's nothing on it. It's
no.
Just,
No, it's
a bit more unadulterated, slightly.
But the album is a really nice piece of work, isn't it? Penultimate. It's a nice.
Well, I was very, very proud of it at the time. There was a huge unfortunate thing happened at the time. Commercially, there was a small war went on behind the scenes between myself and the guy who did the triple vinyl.
Right.
Who immediately went out and launched a whole thing on the assumption that he had the rights for everything, which he didn't have, and he knew that. I think both him and I were going through a bit of a drinking thing at the time, because that's how we'd met. And any time we met, it was always surrounded by drink. And it was, he's completely teetotal now, and I'm not far away, I have to be honest.
Right.
In life, even, and the measure of it, you know, because I can actually look back a bit more and measure how I reacted and how I functioned as I functioned, and probably how much damage I've done to myself over the years. But not in that full-blown alcoholic type thing. I don't mean it that way, but just physically. You know, much of my performance years, I still perform, of course I do, but much of my performance years were wrapped around a physical thing. And I've actually done myself a disservice physically, as opposed to a training thing, you know, where I'll just launch into stuff because I've probably... And I was never pissed, ever. But it was always part of the marmalade thing. It was a few jars before you went on. But sometimes, you know, not that so much the performance side of it, but just in a general lifestyle. And I drank an awful lot throughout my life, you know. And there were periods when it was outrageous, not just me, but those around me, everybody around me. But I would, I was well up there at the front. Doing leg kicks at the age of 64 and, you know, damaging my knees and
it
all that stuff.
It goes with the business, though, doesn't it? It really does.
Oh, you'll get
the
photographs to prove it.
Yeah.
Last leg kick proper was Thailand, and I suffered all the way back in the plane.
And they still talk about it, don't they?
They still talk about it and they still view
in
it.
In Bangkok.
Yeah, well, they did. I didn't, but they did.
Bit of ELO, I think.
Which is also the same influence, don't Jeff Lynne, yeah, sure. Loved Badge, right? Loved George Harrison.
Yeah.
Loved this, you know, he was fortunate enough to transcend into them all.
Indeed.
Jeff Lynne on stage with Sandy Newman and Del Shannon.
That was great.
Alexandra Theatre, yeah.
Wonderful.
And yeah, he was a massive Del fan. So we did the very, very first ever... No, that's a lie. We did the very last ever tour with Del Shannon.
Really?
Did you not know that?
No, I didn't know that.
No, we did that.
Well, I mean, there's so much about your whole career and life that it's massive, isn't it? It's absolutely massive.
I suppose.
You know, our 7 years kind of relationship is a very small part
of
what there is. I mean...
No, there was great. There's been a lot of great moments. If you think about it from that perspective, Nick, there's been a lot of great moments.
Yeah.
And that was one of them for me because, again, when I was a child, kid, the early Beatles albums. At that time, my eldest sister had moved to London. She did a great job. She moved to London. She was gone for some of my senior secondary school years.
Right.
When I started playing bands, not a real proper band, but a three-piece thing that played in a pub when I was 14. I shouldn't have been in a pub, let alone anything else.
Yeah.
But I did Dick's Bar in Duntalker outside Glasgow.
Dick's Bar.
Every Friday night.
Wonderful.
And I replaced somebody. And I can't for the life of remember how I got to know the people. But the people were... The drummer was a time-served mechanic. He'd just finished his apprenticeship, so he was 21. The other guy worked at the Evening Times as a compositor.
Yeah, I remember that.
And he used to take me into the offices when there was serious printing machines.
That's where I started.
Orson Welles movies, you know, that's
all
the history. I saw all that shit in the
fantastic
Glasgow, the Evening Times.
Great era, great times.
Sitting there on the... literacy.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Literacy
yeah,
for adults.
That. Yeah. Yeah, changing the headline and God knows what else, changing the front page.
Is this wee three-piece thing? And then it gravitated from there. And I joined, it was called the Crescents. There was a time when, so the older guy was a motor mechanic. Unfortunately, he just passed away 10 days ago. However, he was my main influence, but he took me to his passion at that age, the Barrowland Ballroom, to see the Searchers live, because he was a rabid Searchers fan. So, people that I know in life now.
Yeah, now I know.
I saw, a wee boy, yeah. In amongst this big crowd.
I've had so many, many experiences like that, you know, it's really...
Well, you probably photographed more than half of them.
Absolutely crazy.
Yeah.
You know, to go back to that point, and which is really what this show is all based on, how I come to do what I do and listen to the music and literally sitting there in a darkened room,
yep.
You know, with all these thoughts and dreams and wishes and hopes, you know, that God Almighty, that's what I want to do and this is where I want to go. And,
well, I never,
you know...
From that perspective, I never thought, as I don't know, 13-year-old, 12-year-old, 13-year-old, whatever it was, I think one of my friends at the time who had lived in Canada and came back here, his mother was Scottish, father was English. It was a friend of mine, and it was all to do with sort of football, which I was sort of half into, but not really.
Sure. You
know, Glasgow was a... I did like football when I was young. But I was wise enough to support Partick Thistle.
Right. Is that a wise move, then?
Massively, yeah. It's a bit like, you know, because everything about Glasgow... I didn't know this as a child, but influences come across. My father had been born and brought up a Catholic completely.
Right.
Completely. In Burma.
In Burma?
Yeah.
He was
the eldest son of a large Catholic family. His father... was the chief of customs for the British government.
Yeah, you did tell me.
So he was brought up... Again, you don't know that when you're a kid. You don't know.
No.
And he had met my mum only because he had brought her father home from a ship that he was sailing on later in life. He'd left home quite young, actually. He left home... There was never an answer to that one, but he left home as the eldest of nine, quite young. I think perhaps one can only assume maybe a disagreement with the father. You will. I don't know. I don't know. Nobody does.
No.
You will become maybe, you know, that thing.
Yeah.
But it was a strong personality, my father. And he left. He left when he was 17 and a half. He left home. Now, but home was a place with guard dogs, staff everywhere.
Yeah.
That was the nature of the gig.
Yeah. You know?
Chief of Customs for the British government.
Yeah.
Rangoon, so... And he brought my mother's father home from a ship that he... The mother's father was a chief engineer on. He'd always been... Because my mother came from Fife. But he was a serious sauce merchant.
Okay.
You know.
Lots of sherbet.
A sherbet or a few. It appears, you know. So much so that I learned much later in life that it was a 13-year absence in China.
Okay.
And Burma.
Right.
Anyway, so that was how my father met my mother, and he never left Glasgow after that, apart from war years when he worked in the Merchant Navy.
Right.
So it was must have been love.
Yeah, yeah.
And he gave up everything. So I was brought up as a Protestant, if you like.
Okay.
Because my mother was a Protestant. But there was never a huge... Yeah, I went to Sunday school and things, and I was, you know, Sunday best and all that kind of vibe. But it never really, it wasn't as deep as it may have been for totally convicted parents.
Okay.
And there was always a slackness and looseness. My father played the game, basically, if you like.
Yeah.
Until my mother died, and then he went back.
Right. Nice stories. How we all got here.
But I'm trying to think of the point of the story. What was the point of the story?
Don't know. Don't matter, though, does it? Don't matter.
No, it was that looseness. It was Rangers and Celtic, basically, they were coming from football teams. There was always a sort of little grey area where you never wanted to convict you. Because everybody only wanted to know, did you support Rangers or Celtic? In other words, in the language of the day, are you a Fenian bastard or are you a proddy? No, and that would depend on who was asking you the question. That
of course,
be, that
yeah.
would be the proddy asking yeah. you the question. You know?
They're
there's still, I'm sorry to say, however they try and dress up, it's still there. It's still there in Scotland, and particularly in that area, these football teams. There's still an element of it, is my point.
Of course.
As there still is that element in Northern Ireland, there still is the element. It's all on the undercurrents. It's all buried behind great treasures in life and blah, blah, blah. But there's still a fucking hatred. One way and other.
Nonsense.
So supporting Partick Thistle was great because you were just assumed to be a complete idiot. But I actually
so
did
the neutral
support.
Line.
The only time I ever went to football games, which I was allowed to do as a real youngster, to go up from my house in Scotchton, Glasgow, which is just next to Clyde Bank, really,
yep.
on the way where the shipyards were. The whole river stuff. It was all the way up. It was shipyards. We working men with bonnets and stuff. That's what I grew up looking at, you know, cutting your way through the fog when it was smoggy in the wintertime, you know.
Willy proper
boots,
industrial Scotland,
leg.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. But there was a heart with that though, wasn't there?
Aye.
I mean,
aye.
You know, it,
aye, son.
And yeah. I think the whole country lacks that kind of thing now. It hasn't got the substance, the attitude, and the emotion.
No, well,
has it?
You know, expectations have risen beyond all reality, actually.
Yeah.
I think expectations have risen beyond what can be achieved.
Yeah, I totally agree.
For the main
agree.
People. Therefore, a celebrity takes over. And it's just an observation. It can be ageist, you can view it whichever way you like. But, you know, celebrity is just a major function in everybody's vision, and in many ways, even if they don't have it completely. But there's a whole culture of people who just feel that they deserve things. But they don't deserve things. Because you need to work to deserve things. Music.
Bit of Pete. This is a fantastic track.
Unreal.
I was a huge fan of, Pete Green's Fleetwood Mac.
Nobody could touch
what he was doing.
And was it Jeremy Spencer? The other guy?
Yep.
I mean, he doesn't get any credit, but he's fucking great as well.
Oh, yeah, totally.
Great.
Yeah.
But no, your man, the feel, the touch, the whole thing. Somebody was talking about this to me recently. He said, munching his crisps.
His kettle.
Somebody explain it. For the life of me, I can't remember what it was. It was a cult thing that him and some other people were introduced to. Oh, I wish I could remember. It was an answer to something that I'd
what,
never...
something to do with Pete Green?
Yeah. But it was also a few other people, and he went for it. And the other people went, this is bollocks. After nearly going for it. But he went, and it just fucked him up completely.
Really? Yeah, it's... He went into a dark place... Seriously dark place, yeah, yeah. I know he, because, I mean, I did some editorial stuff with a guy, I don't know, early noughties, I would have said, you know, probably 2002, 2003, something like that. Put it this way, he was a big guy. He looked, you know, kind of physically out of condition, the rest of it. He lived relatively... a subdued life, I think, at that time. And I think he lived in Leicestershire somewhere. I think he did. He came out to do this very small tour.
No, he came out for a bit, yeah.
You know, and he was Was he as good as he was? I don't know. I never saw him in his day. But it was certainly, it was something special even then. But I think it was a case that he kind of looked to, as if to say, well, you know, I'm all right tonight, but whether I actually make it here tomorrow night or anywhere tomorrow night, I don't know if I'm that bothered, you know.
I think there was a whole documentary on television about that, actually.
Was there?
Yes.
Right.
Because there was someone about, similar to the Brian Wilson thing. There was the mentor who sort of brought them out of the cupboard, effectively.
Right.
And then it all went quiet for Peter Green. I never found out what happened to the mentor, but the Brian Wilson one was a rip-off merchant.
Is that what it was?
Oh, completely, yeah. Completely. But it was resolved. And I think it was resolved by a guy who was, unfortunately... What, no, it, was after, it wasn't Nashville, it was Los Angeles. I was in Los Angeles. With... a gentleman called Laurie G, the late Laurie G.
Oh, yeah, 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 Laurie's, I knew Laurie. Laurie's yeah, gone. Blockheads. Well, yeah, I met Laurie through the Blockheads.
Blockheads, well, ever.
In Bury, yeah. Yeah. He was totally off a wall, weren't he, Laurie G?
Oh, Laurie, yeah.
Oh, totally.
Oh, no.
Fucking
no.
Bobman, he really was.
Well, Laurie was in the office. Laurie G, wow. Right back to early London stuff.
Yeah.
Laurie J Combo. He was named J by Cliff Richard when he stood in for Tony Meehan on the drum.
Really? That's how it came
so
about?
So Laurie J, yeah, it became a Laurie J. He was a drummer.
Okay.
And he was a Jewish boy already. Lawrence Joseph.
Right. No, I didn't know that.
Well, I didn't until much, well, later, but yeah. My first time I met Laurie J, I was in the Chris McClure section.
Yeah.
And he was the... It looked like doorman, but he was actually the manager of the Scottish St James, which was a club in London in the 60s, yep, where everybody had their table. I can't say that's a Beatles table.
Okay.
That's Mick's table. That's just wee Stevie Marriott. That's all that.
Right.
And some of the Scottish bands started playing there. The first time I was there was to see... I was in London with the Chris McClure section. We were playing at the Bag of Nails in Kingly Street. And with a couple of nights off, and there was a manager who'd been running one of the offices in Glasgow, a guy called Alex Scott, who later went on to manage and find Stray Cats.
Okay.
And then he Alec became known as Wee Eck with a big check. But no, he was a famous manager in Scotland. He was a real serious guy. And at the time he was in town, he was actually working for the Marmalade, strangely enough. He had just been headhunted when Hugh Nicholson came down to replace Junior Campbell.
Goodness me.
Alec managed the Poets, which is where Hugh came from.
Yeah.
And Alec came down to look after the situation because there was a bit of friction within. And he took us to the Scotch St James to see another band they had managed, which was the Dream Police.
Right.
Does that name ring?
Yeah, but I'm not sure.
Dream Police was Hamish Stewart, which later became Average White Band.
Oh, yeah.
Charlie Smith,
definitely,
who was a drummer, who became, well, it was Marsha Hunt's 22, with versions of the Poets, and then he later became, with me, I got him involved in the Marmalade for the 76 thing.
Right.
And Matt Irvin, who was multi-instrumentalist, that went on to work with Paul Young and Chris Rea, everybody. Well, unfortunately, he's no longer with us. So it was all my formative years. But we went to the Scottish St James with a table with Alex Scott, who was managing Marmalade. Graham Knight's wedding reception, Knight from Marmalade's wedding reception, was in the Scottish St James because Laurie had fixed it up because he was a manager.
Right.
So we were welcomed and stuff. So that's the first time I met him. The next time I met him, I'm in the Marmalade. The office is in Notting Hill, Kensington Park Road.
Yep.
74A, up the stairs.
Yep.
Every morning, Russ Conway would walk past going to get his paper from Katie, the wee newsagent down the road. She, who liked me, I was a nice boy. Katie vetted all the punters that came from the office. It was brilliant. Yeah. So,
great times.
Yeah, it was great times. And there was a garden opposite where I mean, we did two sessions for EMI photographs just across from the office in the gardens.
Bloody hell, wonderful.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah, man, you guys was coming. Yeah, you know the story. Yeah, you've done all your time, you know. Oh, that's a good spot. Let's just use that. That's handy. Get to the next gig.
Terrific stories.
But, yeah. So Laurie was in there. He was in there. And that's how the Billy Ocean thing came around. Because Billy was signed to Peter Walsh Management.
Right.
We love Really Hurts and Red
Light. Yeah,
And then it all started to go downhill for some reason, I don't know. And Laurie was downstairs, and a lot of people say it this way, Laurie poached Bill, because he was, you know, if you ever met, did you meet the man?
No.
Did you meet Laurie?
No. Oh, yeah, I met Laurie, yeah.
Oh, you met Laurie, oh, yeah, so you know what I'm saying.
Yeah, yeah.
Could he talk you up?
Yeah, complete.
Sandy! That's brilliant, it's genius, it's genius, man. What are you doing with all that other shit? Fucking leave it out.
I had a similar experience. Well, I went there with, Mick Geiger from the Blockheads.
Mickey, yeah.
Yeah, and also Derek the Draw, who now fronts the Blockies.
No, Derek the Draw had his own compartment in Laurie's office.
Yeah, he did.
To pick up the... Yeah. Oh,
yeah.
I know.
Yeah.
I had the key.
complete wild. Completely wild. Totally mental.
We were sort of partners for two, 3 years.
Oh, right.
Because of John.
Right.
Laurie took the bait with John. If I was in musical, I would always take it to Laurie first, no matter where it was.
Right.
And when I took him, John, and I knew what Laurie was, I knew what he was capable of in terms of bullshit, but I knew when he was genuine as well.
Yeah,
I mean, I took him, John, as a young boy coming back from America with a lot of angst and all this. He freaked out. It was like a fucking answer to a prayer for him in his head. And we took it the whole journey, hence of me being in Los Angeles with Laurie.
Sure.
Because we were there to try and get John a deal. And then I found out that I was working with an era of past it. Not me so much, but... You know, we were there for 2 weeks. We were staying in Mary Steven's house, because he used to manage Mary Steven.
Right.
Mary Steven had been Miss World.
Okay.
Laurie managed Mary Steven when she was Miss World.
Yeah.
Right? Before he ended up managing Billy Ocean. And it's just, it's incestuous. It goes all back to that period, man.
Well, massive, massive stories. I mean, it's been fantastic, Sand. I think, you know, it's probably... We're getting to that point in the night where I think we should probably look at saying, well, let's save some more and bring you back. Come round again for another weekend.
I'm up for it.
Another night in.
Absolutely, yeah.
So I think, you know, it's probably time that we both kind of looked at, you know, sacking it and you got on the way home.
Yeah, okay,
and man. But, man, what fantastic stories.
You got some good gear.
And just brilliant. I'm so, so pleased and honoured to have such a legend.
Don't be silly, man. I never think of myself as a legend. I think more of Jamie Dodgers as a legend.
There they are.
I think I feel before, as a parting gift, I think you should have one.
I'll have one. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And thanks Sandy. And let's see you again soon, my friend.
Pleasure.
Can't wait.
Cheers.
Stay safe. Bye-bye, mate. Bye-bye.
Bye.
A Night In is brought to you by Ashwood Music.